She came from Providence, one in Rhode Island, where the old world shadows hang heavy in the air. She packed her hopes and dreams like a refugee, just as her father came across the sea. She heard about a place people were smiling. They spoke about the red man's weight and how they loved the land. And they came from everywhere to the great divide, seeking a place to stand or a place to hide. Down in the crowded bars, out for a good time, can't wait to tell you all what it's like up there. They call it paradise, I don't know. Somebody laid the mountains low while the town got
listeners, same time, same place, from noon to 1 p.m. on Penguin Radio. It's me, DJ Double M, and my show, Do's and Don'ts. I'm glad you're with me on this rainy Tuesday morning. Today's show is going to be quite diverse. Even though I'm going to mostly talk about health, I'm going to talk about it from very different perspectives. And my first segment is going to be about drugs that are commonly used by teenagers today. I'm gonna confess, I do like to go out and socialize whenever I get the chance to, whenever I have some free time. I like to meet new people, I like to go clubbing, which in Europe is not considered bad at all. But I've never tried any drugs, including marijuana, because I'm really, really against it. Even though I haven't tried them, which wouldn't be a secret in this case, because I think that would be a good thing to share for this segment if I would have had any experience in that sphere. But even though I haven't, I've seen people who have, and I've seen the effect of them. So this is exactly why I chose to talk about drugs in my segment, in my first segment of the day, because I was interested in what some people may consider me to be missing, what is so amazing, so to say, about them, and what is the substance that's changed my friends and people who I thought I would know. And who I did know for a long time, because after using some drugs, they turn into, well, unrecognizable people. So I'm going to discuss the lightest one, of my segment first, which is marijuana. Yes, people usually backbone its usage by saying that it is better to smoke marijuana than to smoke cigarettes. But after doing my research, I must ask, where the hell did they find that kind of information? Because all I did, it wasn't actually that hard. I just typed in Google marijuana versus cigarettes, and many results came up, and all of them were saying the same thing, that in fact, when equal amounts of marijuana and tobacco are smoked, marijuana deposits four times as much tar into your lungs than cigarettes do. And this is because marijuana joints are unfiltered and often more deeply inhaled than cigarettes. Marijuana smoke is also an irritant to the lungs, and frequent marijuana smokers can have many or the same respiratory problems experienced by people who smoke tobacco. So these include coughing, phlegm production on most days, on daily basis, wheezing, bronchitis, and greater risk of lung infections. Marijuana has many effects on the brain too. I bet you've noticed that if you have any stoner, so to say, friends. It impairs short-term memory and motor coordination, slows reaction time, alerts mood, judgment, and decision-making, and in some people, cases can cause severe anxiety or loss of touch with reality. So because of these effects, marijuana used more than doubles a driver's risk of being in an accident. And I've actually, talking about the brain, I've noticed that on my close friends who I've known for a really long time before they started smoking marijuana. And then when they did, I've noticed that their reactions became slower, that they wouldn't remember the things I told them one day ago. And it was just weird. They were just slower. And you know, they had that empty glance that usually people who smoke a lot of weed have. I'm not talking about those who do that once a month. I guess that's normal in our culture, even though it's not for me, but for most people it is. I'm talking about those who use it like cigarettes or daily, on daily basis. And this is really bad because marijuana also affects the heart. The heart rate is raised from 20 to 100% shortly after smoking, an effect which can last up to 3 hours and put users at an increased risk of heart attack. Which is actually no joke, because I knew this one girl who had heart problems, and after smoking marijuana, it got way worse. She had to go to the hospital. Of course, she probably mixed it with alcohol or other substances, but it got ugly. I don't even want to get into detail of that story, but it's enough to know that it's just really bad. Marijuana use can affect the general quality of the user's life as well. Heavy marijuana users generally report lower life satisfaction, poorer mental and physical health, relationship problems, and less academic or career success compared to their other peers. You might get a better grade once or twice, but according to many, many research and studies, it's not going to last. It's going to be like a one-time effect, and then it's going to boomerang effect on you. So this is something really interesting, what I'm about to say, so listen carefully. Marijuana use is particularly harmful to youth, since the part of the brain that craves pleasure matures earlier than the area that controls our ability to understand risks and consequences. So this may explain a lot of stupid mistakes that young people do, even though I don't really want to believe that, but it's a good excuse. I mean, it's at least a decent one, and at least a researched and studied one, and not some out-of-air excuse. So a national study by Monitoring the Future showed that in 2012, 1.1% of 8th graders, if you can believe that, 3.5% of 10th graders, and 6.5% of 12th graders, I'm talking about high school, reported using marijuana daily, which is a tragic statistic. I mean, in 8th grade, I didn't even know about its existence, and I'm really glad that I didn't. Marijuana is highly accessible now, especially to older teenagers. In 2012, 37% of 8th graders, 69% of 10th graders, and 82% of 12th graders reported marijuana as being fairly easy or very easy to get. Studies show that as availability increases, perception on harm decreases, and this is, you know, not a big surprise. So there are some good news whatsoever, that the perception that there is no great risk in smoking marijuana is decreasing among youth. So this is good. This is something we want to be happy about. Because again, if to go to detail of the statistics, in 2012, 66.9% of 8th graders, 50.9% of 10th graders, and 44.1% of 12th graders said that there was a great risk in smoking marijuana regularly, on daily basis, for example. These numbers had been steadily declining over the last 6 years, according to a site that I've been researching it in, which is called lungs.org. If you want more information about this or about the comparison between the two, marijuana and cigarettes or tobacco, just check the site out. It has a lot of information, and I think it's useful to everyone to know, especially nowadays and especially for young people. Marijuana is thought to be not addictive. And however, marijuana dependence is the number one reason why youth in Colorado and the U.S. seek substance abuse treatment. Youth are more likely than adults to become addicted to marijuana. This is not a big surprise, and the same thing is with alcohol. I bet you all have heard something about it. About 4.1 million people in the U.S. meet clinical criteria for marijuana dependence. THC stimulates brain cells to release the chemical dopamine, which creates an euphoric feeling, a really great feeling, relaxation, and can lead to physical addiction. So similar to tobacco withdrawal, people trying to quit marijuana say that they're more irritable, they have sleeping difficulties, they wake up in the middle of the night, they crave smoking, and they have anxiety attacks. And another really interesting fact about this is that smokers who use both tobacco and marijuana tend to smoke more cigarettes per month than those who only use tobacco, according to the research presented Sunday as a part of Pediatric Academic Society's annual meeting in Washington, D.C. So I'm done with marijuana and tobacco, and I'm moving on to another popular drug, usually referred as to the club drug. And I'm talking about ecstasy or its forms like Molly or MDMA. We haven't had the song, Please Help Me Find Molly, so you probably know what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the nice colorful pills your friends showed you with the nice logos and looking ridiculously similar to candy. So it's, you know, it looks alluring. Ecstasy is illegal. The Drug Enforcement Administration classifies it as a Schedule 1 drug, a description reserved for dangerous substances with no recognized medical use. Other Scheduled 1 drugs include heroin and LSD, which I bet you know that are really serious drugs. Penalties for possession, delivery, and manufacturing of ecstasy can include jail sentences of 4 years to life and fines from $250,000 to $4 million, which is not cheap, I must say, depending on the amount of the drug you have in your possession. Tragically, ecstasy is one of the most popular drugs among youth today. The UN Office of Drugs and Crime estimates ecstasy users to number approximately 9 million worldwide, which sadly is 3 times more than Lithuania's, my country's population. We have only 3 million people, so imagining that people use ecstasy 3 times wider than the spread of my country's population is just crazy. The vast majority of users are, unsurprisingly, teenagers and young adults. And probably the reason for that is that, you know, they have their fun for a minute, for an evening, for a night. They dance and it looks fun and they don't ever look into the consequences. They don't do their research, because I must admit, if I would have ever done this, I would have freaked out if I would read this information that I'm about to share with you guys. Mixed with alcohol, ecstasy is extremely dangerous and can, in fact, be deadly because your heart rate hops a lot. So widespread has been the harm of this designed drug that emergency room indicates have skyrocketed more than 1,200% since ecstasy became the club drug of choice at all-night rave parties and dance clubs. So leading off this, I want to read you a story I found on drugfreeworld.com, which, by the way, is a really good site too. Nikki was like many other who went to rave parties. Hoping to escape her problems and have a good time, she planned to party through the night with several friends. One of them had a bottle of liquid ecstasy in his car, so they all decided to take some. Soon the drug started to take over. Nikki danced and danced and danced, pushing herself well beyond her usual limits. As one of her friends later said to the police officer, Nikki wasn't feeling anything. The next morning, Nikki was dead. The cause? Drug, ecstasy, poisoning. But what's going to happen to me? It's not going to happen to me, you think. Maybe not, but do you really want to take the risk? Do you want to take a chance? Do you want to try? What's so alluring about that? At a rave party, I saw a guy who had stuffed himself with ecstasy and repeated for hours, I'm an orange, don't peel me. I'm an orange, don't peel me. Don't peel me, I'm an orange. And another guy who thought he was a fly and wouldn't stop hitting his head against the window. So this is a comment of one user of the site, drugfreeworld.com, and it's a comment of Liz. And I bet this is a really good reflection of what the drug does to you, and it's terrible. I mean, it's just crazy. And now I'm going to talk a little bit about the drug's history. So I think this information is interesting, at least for me it was. Ecstasy was originally developed by Merck Pharmaceutical Company in 1912. In its original form, it was known as MDMA, and this name is still sometimes used. It was then used in 1953 by the U.S. Army in psychological warfare tests, and then resurfaced in the 1960s as a psychotherapy medication to lower inhibitions. It wasn't until the 1970s that MDMA started being used as a party drug. By the early 1980s, MDMA was being promoted as the hottest thing in the continuing search for happiness through chemistry and the in drug for many weekend parties. Still legal in 1984, MDMA was being sold under the brand name of ecstasy. But by 1985, the drug had been banned due to safety concerns. Apparently, someone has given their common sense. Since the late 1980s, ecstasy has become an embracing marketing term for drug dealers selling ecstasy type drugs that may in fact contain very little of actual MDMA at all. And while MDMA itself can produce harmful effects, what is called ecstasy today can contain a wide mixture of substances from LSD, cocaine, heroin, amphetamine, and meth to, now listen, this is crazy, rat poison, caffeine, dog deworming substances, etc. Despite the Q's logos dealers put on the pills, this is what makes ecstasy particularly dangerous. A user never really knows what is he or she taking, actually. You never know what is going to be in the pill you're taking. And the dealers have no obligation to not lie to you. They're illegal. What do you, like, how can you trust someone who's illegal? The dangers are increased when users increase the dose seeking a previous high, not knowing what they may be taking, an entirely different combination of drugs. Ecstasy most commonly comes in pill form, but can also be injected and taken in other ways. Liquid ecstasy is actually GHB, a nervous system depressant, a substance that can cause also, or that can also be found in drain cleaner, floor stripper, and degreasing solvents, which is absolutely crazy. And you do not want that in your digestive system. You do not want to put that in your body. It's just unbelievably stupid. And it's really sad, but one site that I've read said that Molly is being marketed mostly to young, first-time drug abusers between the ages of 12 and 17. This is just simply unbelievable. I would never, honestly myself, I would never believe that. And I think this segment was a clear do not do drugs and do not use drugs. And I hope that this information is going to serve you somewhat in the future. And I'm going to talk about best foods to prevent cancer. And yes, that's a thing in my next segment. And see you after our short break.
No woman of God. Everything's gonna be alright. matches in some place we've never been. Come you hang the phone up the minute I walk in. It's not I had this dream that I was losing you. I woke up in a cold sweat shaking, resting me, my heart is breaking. Say it isn't so. In a baby movie, say it isn't so. Say it isn't so. Tell me it's a lie. Say everything's alright. Say it isn't so.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Double M, and you're listening to my show Do's and Don'ts on Penguin Radio. You can tune in on radio.dominican.edu. In my last segment, I discussed the bad side of using drugs, and in the upcoming one, I'm going to talk about really healthy foods. I think this topic might be relevant to all of us because, let's be true here, a college lifestyle isn't always that healthy. Lack of sleep and partying on top of that can sink anyone out during the months at college. So this might sound a bit controversial, but I find it interesting, and I'm going to talk about foods that prevent cancer. I know we're not having cancer right now because we're young and beautiful, but you know, from the future, it couldn't be bad to become a little bit more healthy. So do anti-cancer foods really work? The short answer is yes, they actually do. While studies are ongoing, and in many cases experts still don't exactly know how these superfoods work, there's strong evidence that certain foods and vegetables rich in plant-based nutrients can both prevent tumors from starting and help their growth. So, do eat berries. I bet you all like berries, and especially because the spring is coming, they're actually in their best shape. The rich dark colors of blueberries, Brazilian acai berries, raspberries, and cranberries come from psychochemicals that protect against numerous types of cancer. Most recently, researchers at the University of Florida found that the active ingredient in acai berries destroyed cancer cells when tested in cell cultures. And blueberries and Muscadine grapes contain compounds that recent research showed to cause cancer cells in their liver to self-destruct. So this is a really good and healthy food. In studies particularly important to women, cranberries have recently been discovered to be an important weapon in the fight against deadly ovarian cancer. Studies reported at the annual meeting of the American Chemical Society, food that ovarian cancer cells that were becoming resistant to platinum chemotherapy. The standard of care to ovarian cancer became 6 times more sensitive when exposed to a compound of cranberries. The anti-cancer properties of all these berries are so strong that researchers have developing concentrated supplements and other products such as purees and concentrates. So this is just a proof that it actually should work. One of the first plant-based chemicals to be studied for its anti-cancer properties, catechins, the chemicals in green tea, have been known for some time to prevent and reduce the risk of cancer, such as breast cancer. So just 2 cups of green tea a day is a really good start for that, and it also makes your metabolism faster. So I would recommend to drink 1 cup of green tea with your breakfast and another one before nighttime, because it doesn't have so much caffeine to make you not fall asleep. Garlic might stink or make you cry, but numerous studies over the years, more than 30 different studies to date, have documented that anti-cancer properties of garlic actually do work. The strongest evidence so far has focused on digestive cancers, but garlic appears to protect against all type of cancer, including breast and prostate. So according to the National Cancer Institute, an analysis of 7 different large-scale population studies showed that the more raw and cooked garlic a person consumed, the lower his or her risk of stomach and cholesterol cancer are. One study found that middle-aged women who regularly consume garlic had even 50% lower risk of developing colon cancer. Scientists have isolated 2 active ingredients in garlic, allicin and allyl sulfur, and demonstrated that they prevent and fight cancer in both animals and humans. You can take garlic in supplement form, but the capsules must be enteric coated to protect these active ingredients, because if they're not, they're not going to be working as well as you expect them to work. Add crushed fresh garlic to whatever meat you're having, whatever meal you're having, to salad dressing, to literally whatever you're eating. So this is a good way to be more healthy, and it also adds to your immune system. You're not going to get a cold so fast and so easily if you're going to consume more garlic. I bet you heard that one. So not everyone likes broccoli, but British researchers made headlines last year with a study that showed that men with early signs of developing prostate cancer prevented tumor growth by eating broccoli 4 times a week. Other studies have shown anti-cancer benefits from eating cabbage, Brussels sprouts, and other cruciferous vegetables, which I personally like. Most people don't, apparently, and especially younger, but I personally like these foods. According to the National Institutes of Health, studies of people from Southern Europe who eat a diet high in garlic and onions is a new thing for us, show a direct relationship between high consumption of allium vegetables, all types of garlic, onions, and leeks, and the reduced risk of many common cancers too. So onions are good for you too, not only garlic. Tomatoes come in different forms, ketchup, cherry tomatoes, yellow or even green tomatoes, whatever serves your taste. So I'm not going to believe that you just hate all the tomatoes. You must like the ketchup on the pizza, even if you don't like the tomato as a vegetable or as a... Actually, it's said to be a berry now, but whatever, it's weird. So Harvard researcher Edward Gianowicz reviewed 72 different studies published by a National Cancer Institute and concluded that lycopene and... which is the active chemical in tomatoes, lower the risk of many different cancers, particularly prostate, breast, lung, and colon cancer. So if you're a smoker, enjoy your tomatoes. Subsequently, the FDA conducted a review of its own and disagreed, refusing food companies requested to label tomato products with an anti-cancer health promotion message. However, many experts believe that FDA's process was flawed and the tomatoes will be vindicated by further studies. So I'm going to just stick to the belief that they do help and they are healthy, because, well, let's be true here. If you want to paraphrase this, it's actually the same as talking about just healthy foods. And vegetables, especially natural, that you can get at Trader Joe's or Whole Foods, are usually good for you and usually make your immune system stronger. So it prevents you not from only cancer, but from all the diseases, pretty much. So the good news, cooking tomatoes seems to enhance the effects of lycopene, qualifying tomato-based spaghetti sauce as a nutritional power horse. So bring on the pasta. Eat all the pasta you want. The hype about the red wine centers on an excellent antioxidant called resveratrol that presents in grapes and grape juice, but most actively is concentrated in red wine. Numerous studies show that resveratrol possesses powerful anti-cancer activity. Teams at several universities and cancer centers are studying resveratrol's effects against specific types of cancer. Most frequently, a university in Nebraska study has published in Cancer Prevention Research demonstrated that resveratrol suppresses the abnormal cell growth, and that way it treats breast cancer and similar diseases. Breast cancer is fueled by estrogen, and resveratrol acts to block the action of estrogen, preventing it from feeding tumor growth. So this is biologically explained. Oh my God, whenever I read that kind of stuff, I'm so interested in that, and I feel bad that I didn't choose biology as a part of my major. I could have be a minor in that. It's really interesting, and it helps to improve your life quality, so everyone should more or less read about this and just know what's healthy and what's not, just to, you know, improve your life quality. Previously, research conducted at the University of Alabama at Birmingham showed that mice fed a diet enriched with resveratrol had an 87% reduction in the risk of developing prostate tumors of the most dangerous kind. So the problem, however, is that higher alcohol intake can be bad if you already have cancer. So in that case, you have to take the resveratrol as a supplement, and that's a better idea than using alcohol. Plus, overdosage is always not good. If you like sushi and soy, that I do like, you're about to lift your mood. The active ingredient in soy is genistein, which protects against hormone-dependent cancers. It's also a powerful inhibitor of several proteins that are implicated in the uncontrolled growth of cancer cells. To get the anti-cancer benefits of soy, you need to consume about 50 grams per day. On the whole foods, such as raw fresh soybeans, dry roasted soybeans, or tofu. The roasted soybeans is a classical food at any Asian restaurant you go, so it's easy to get. But remember, you want it natural, especially if you eat tofu. Don't buy it at just any supermarket. Buy it at Trader Joe's, because usually they're too modified to be actually good for you and can result in the decrease of your health. So the orange-yellow spice turmeric, best known for its role in Indian curries or other Asian dishes, fights cancer because of an effective ingredient, curcumin, that's a powerful antioxidant. Researchers at Ohio State University in Columbus reviewed numerous animal studies and concluded that curcumin demonstrated anti-cancer effects at virtually all stages of tumor development. Researchers in France and Britain also have been studying curcumin's action in the laboratory of the researching and concluded that it prevents and slows tumor cell growth. So this is a really good food too. Also, it's good to eat watercress, even though it's not really a common thing in the American diet. Maybe it should become, because Europeans who eat a lot of this thing are said to have less risk for cancer too. So, you know, it's really a better way to, everyone's talking about muscles and about, you know, nice bodies and stuff. And I'll agree that's a nice thing to have. But if you can actually improve your health that much to prevent cancer, that's a better way or a better goal to actually be interested in. But in case I actually mentioned muscles already and the summer body thing going on, in my next segment, I'm going to discuss the foods that are going to help you reduce your belly fat. And I hope that's going to be more interesting than this, because this was too scientific. And I'm going to meet you after the break. Everything is going to be all right. Everything is going to be all right. Everything is going to be all right. Everything.
my heart and the roar of the approaching night. Somebody's calling after somebody. Somebody turns the corner out of sight, looking for somebody. Somewhere in the night.
Welcome back, listeners. You're listening to Penguin Radio at radio.dominican.edu. This is my show, Do's and Don'ts, and I'm Double M. So since the summer season is coming and all of us girls undoubtedly want flat bellies to show off at the beach, I'm dedicating a segment to this. I'm going to discuss foods that actually can reduce your belly fat and make your belly flatter. Of course, you still have to exercise if you want the muscle lines, but to just reduce the belly fat that's usually on the bottom of your belly, you can choose to eat more healthy. And actually, these foods are not going to sound tragic. It's not just salad leaves and not just cucumbers or celery. So listen up. An apple a day can keep weight gain at bay. People who used to eat an apple before a pasta meal or whatever meal they choose to eat for a lunch, like a bigger meal, tend to consume overall less calories than those who eat just the meal. And this is, you know, this is difficult to understand because it seems as you eat more, you should get more calories. But actually, the apple is going to fill you up. So that's a really good idea of self-control too, because your belly is actually going to feel full if you eat an apple before that. And plus, the antioxidants in apples may help prevent metabolic syndrome, a condition marked by excess belly fat or an apple shaped, so to call. So no one wants to look like an apple. Apples are the ideal for a low-calorie snack. There are different ways to enjoy your apples. What I like to do for a pie-like treat, if I feel like eating a brownie, is to chop up a medium apple and sprinkle it with a little bit of allspice and a little bit of cinnamon and shove it into the microwave for a minute, and voila, it's a really good warm calorie reduced sweet. However, don't forget that microwaving is not the best choice, and you've probably heard about its consequences and negative effects. So I only do this because I do not have an oven, because I live in the dorms, but you can try to do that while using an oven. That would be a better idea. If you presume that meat makes you get fatter, you're mistaken. Even though beef has a reputation as a diet buster, eating it may help you to peel off pounds. Try to consume local organic beef. That is really important. It's healthier for you and the environment. Eggs are also good. It's a perfect breakfast food. Dig into eggs, yolks, and all. They won't harm your heart, but they can help you trim inches. Omelets and scrambled eggs are obvious choices. Eggs, however, can get boring after a while if you eat them every day, every morning. So to prevent this from happening, try mixing eggs with some tomatoes, spinach, mushroom, or cheese. My personal favorite is spinach and cheese, so I highly recommend this. Talking about breakfast foods, all oats are helpful. But the steel-cut and rolled varieties, which are minimally processed, have up to 5 grams of fiber per serving, making them the most filling choice. Instant oats contain 3 to 4 grams per serving, so you can adjust to this. A good idea is to, instead of using breadcrumbs, add oats to your meatloaf. This is really creative. I've never tried it, but I think that might be a good idea. Research shows that dieters who ate foods containing monounsaturated fats like nuts and nut butters, such as peanut butter, lost more belly fat than those who ate the same number of calories with less of the fats. So this is something new. It's not always like it looks like. So no matter what your favorite nut or nut butter is, try to limit your portions, because too much of anything is bad for you. So just eat one tablespoon of nut butter and like a half of cup maybe nuts a day. That's not going to harm you, and it's going to keep you energetic. And by the way, nuts are brain food too, so you're going to think more fastly and accurately. One of my favorite personals is Greek yogurt. Not only is Greek yogurt higher in filling protein than regular yogurt, it also contains good bacteria, which is probiotics, that may reduce the bad bacteria in the inserts responsible for belly bloating. So a 6-ounce serving is ideal, and you can add your favorite fruit, nuts, or whole grain cereal for added flavor and texture. I used to always do that, and I love it. Mushrooms are the only natural plant source of vitamin D. Insufficient levels of vitamin D have been linked to higher levels of belly fat. Look for mushrooms that are labeled as being exposed to ultraviolet light, as those will have even higher levels of vitamin D. Mushrooms add a great meaty texture to everything from a salad to a pasta dish. So if you want to be full and healthy eating person, choose mushrooms in your dishes, especially for lunch. My go-to after workout snack always involves a cup of low-fat chocolate milk. It has the perfect ratio of carbs and protein to help to muscles to build and reduce fat. So it's actually not bad. Keep your serving to 8 ounces and make sure you get a low-fat milk, like 1% or 2% or non-fat version. And it's going to be a healthy and actually a really sweet snack. Popcorn is a good idea too, even though it looks unhealthy because, you know, because of the cinema image they have, because you always get Coke and popcorn. Yeah, so this is the problem. You need to eat only popcorn because it's good. It's grain and it's whole grain. And studies show that people who eat whole grains have less belly fat than those who eat refined grains. Beans are a great belly flattening food too, because research shows that bean eaters weigh less and have slimmer waistlines. So girls, beans are good for you. Perhaps this is because they are relatively low in calories but high in filling fiber. And if you're afraid that the fiber in beans will cause gas and bloating, just be sure to drink a lot of water, and this is going to prevent that problem from happening. Quinoa is a whole grain like popcorn, which makes it a great tummy trimmer. As an added bonus, quinoa is the only grain that is also a complete protein, and protein helps us feel fuller longer, so this prevents us from eating unhealthy snacks. So this is a really good way to flatten your belly too. Enjoy it with fruit as a breakfast option, or called as a part of a salad, lunch, or dinner. All fruits and veggies are really good because they have from 80 to 90% of water in them. This means you're practically not eating anything, and they are really low in calories. Plus, the fiber they contain helps you feel fuller longer, so you lose fat without feeling hungry all the time. So, and since the summer is coming, watermelons are going to be great, tomatoes are going to be great, and leafy greens are going to not be disappointing too. So dig into the veggies and fruits. They're always good for you. And now we're going on a break. And on my last segment, I'm going to discuss something that is relevant to any college student who has ever interviewed anyone. How to do a simple and an effective interview. How to be a good interviewer. So, see you then.
I'm to see in motion. Let's make a fun devotion. I'm with you on that notion.
Welcome back, listeners. This is my last segment of today. You're listening to Penguin Radio. This is my show, Do's and Don'ts, and I'm DJ Double M. So my show has been about health and foods and drugs and how it's bad to use them so far. And this segment is going to be really not relevant to any of those topics because I'm going to talk about interviews and how to effectively take them. Because we are college students, we have research papers, and it's sometimes hard because it sounds like something really easy to do. You know, like for my first interview, for example, I didn't even write down any questions. I just went there and I was expecting the conversation to go with the flow. But you know what? This is not what was happening. So to do a good interview, you have to prepare before that. You have to write down some questions and you have to know how to schedule it and how to make the questions actually effective so the answers would be what you are actually expecting to hear. So the first do is do ask simple direct questions. These are questions that start with what, how, and why. This requires a source to describe what happened, how did it happen, why it happened. So this is a really good question because it's not an overrun one, and the one who is answering, the one who are you interviewing, is not going to have to really expand his or her answer and to be direct too. So it's a good choice. Don't ask closed-ended questions. Yes, no questions, for example, like did you, will you? Elect yes or no answers. Try to avoid those because what are you going to say about that? It's not like you're going to quote your question and then a simple yeah or no answer. It's just boring and you're not going to use it in any serious research paper. So remember not to do that when you write down your questions. Do remember that less is more. Short questions produce succinct answers. Long rambling questions get long and rambling answers. So you need to not expand your questions so it would be well understandable and so that the one who is being interviewed would get exactly what are you expecting to hear, what sort of an answer to that. And they shouldn't have to re-ask you. They shouldn't have to make sure is that exactly what you're asking. So they should be really clear. So yes, don't ask long and rambling questions because you're going to confuse your source or give them an out to not answer. So that would be a bad idea. Don't ask more than one question at a time. Questions like, what program do you like most? And what's the what's the biggest advantage it has over other programs? Allow sources to answer the easiest question first and then just forget the rest of the question you've asked. So this is a bad idea too. You don't want to re-ask it. You probably don't have a lot of time. And to quote that, you're going to have to change the material. And this can result in a really bad consequence, and you probably know that. You know, the one who you interviewed could read your research paper or whatever you're working on and be really unsatisfied by how you presented his or her words. So in order to avoid that, just keep this in mind. Do keep your opinions to yourself. Don't state your opinion, and don't try to lead the one who you interviewed to hold the same opinion as you. Your opinion is the most not important part in the story. If you appear to have an agenda in reporting a story, you will lose your credibility with listeners, and that's how it is everywhere, even in public speaking, even in radio shows and in research papers too. Don't ask self-answering questions too. For example, what was going through your head when you were held hostage? Because it must have been really scary. That's a good example. You know, don't lead them on an answer. That's pretty much the same as the previous do, because this could affect their answer. And if you're going to quote exactly word to word what your interviewer has said, it's going to be hard to do so without annoying them. Do ask for details, example, and anecdotes. It's always good to keep a little bit of humor in your material, because it's just more interesting to listen, and you probably agree with that one. So specific examples and personal stories make more compelling narratives, especially if you can get to like really small details about personal lives. That's interesting. I'm not talking about criticizing or trying to get too deep. I'm just talking about something that would be relevant to any human being, because I read this in a magazine, and I think that it holds so much truth, the simple phrase that the most important thing to us people is other people and their lifestyles, the ones we can learn from, or, you know, even mistakes, the ones we can learn not to do. So, yes, don't do jargons in an interview. You're going to lose your credibility. And if you can't understand the jargon or the point being made, say something like, for those of us who aren't microbiologists, how would you explain this? How would you, you know, just try to get out an explanation without making yourself looking stupid and just asking like, what that is? Because that is going to lower your credibility too. Do approach to issues by using open-ended questions. Asking a source, are you racist, will almost certainly prompt you a no answer. Instead, ask focused, open-ended questions based on evidence that indicates the source is racist. Use the facts of their past, for example. If you are asking such a question, you have reason to ask such a question. So just take that reason. Be honest, and you're gonna get more credibility and more people who are going to be willing to answer normally to your question. So do strategize how to get a difficult, sensitive issues. Statistic reported that 1/3 of the school children in a district were going without breakfast. Asking the children directly, do you eat breakfast this morning, would likely produce less than truthful responses, since children don't want to admit they're poor and hungry. Instead, ask the child, what's the first thing you do in you have done when you got up this morning? When was that? What did you after that? And after that? And now you're going to know what is the answer. So you have to know how to walk in circles to get exactly the answers you want to hear. Do you put the burden of proof on the source? If a source insists the program is a huge success, ask him to define success. Ask him why, in what sphere, and how was it successful, and when the success started to show, and what he or she indicates to be the kickstart of the success. So this is just going to be getting into more detail. And don't settle for a not good answer. Keep asking, keep getting into more detail to get a specific answer. And you can walk around in circles all you want. Just don't let the one who you are interviewing to walk around in circles. So be aware of the emotional shift and the body language. Check how your interviewer reacts to whatever you're saying, and be sure to not offend him or her in any way, to not hurt their feelings, because they're just going to close up that way and they're not going to give out any information, especially anything that you would want to hear. Because to have a good interview, the one who are you interviewing, your source, must trust in you. They must not feel the safety instincts, you know. They should feel open, and as they would be talking to a friend. So you want them to like you and to trust you. And be afraid of silence. If there's silence, just let it be. it's better to actually know exactly what you're going to ask after than to ask anything just to avoid the silence. So, and the most important and the last thing in this segment is going to be listen carefully and quietly. I know it's really hard sometimes and you want to show that you're listening. That is exactly a lot of people do. Okay, yep. So they're just gonna ruin your source's attention and probably yours is too. Instead, like, for showing that you're listening carefully, for showing your interest in the topic and in the answer, just maintain good eye contact and the right posture. Don't cross your arms, don't cross your legs, don't look too relaxed, and look like you're listening and like you're enjoying the topic. So, and by this, I'm going to end my today's show. I hope you're going to tune in next Tuesday from noon to 1 p.m. And have a great afternoon. See you then.